It's Tuesday, January 28, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Tonight is the State of the Union Address. President Barack Obama will go before a joint session of Congress in order to report on the state of the nation. In so doing, he'll be responding to his constitutional responsibility, as made clear in Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution, that reads as follows. He shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. End quote. That's all the Constitution says. And yet most presidents have decided to fulfill that responsibility by means of an annual speech. There's nothing in the Constitution that says it is to be a speech. But presidents have generally understood the power of a speech. In years past, that speech has often been something mostly of interest to the Congress itself, an attempt by the president to report on the nation and to try to move legislative proposals important to the president forward in the Congress. But for most of the years when the State of the Union Address was given, the American people had little to no direct access to it. That all changed when the State of the Union became a radio event in the year 1923. President Calvin Coolidge became the first president to deliver that address on live radio. The first television broadcast of the State of the Union Address came in 1947 with President Harry Truman. And now, of course, it's very much a part of America's media and popular culture. Most State of the Union addresses are quickly forgotten. Some of them have long-ranging effects, such as in 1823 when President James Monroe declared what is now known as the Monroe Doctrine, warning European nations to stay out, militarily and in terms of foreign policy, from the Western Hemisphere. In 1848, President James Polk helped to start the gold rush in California when, in his State of the Union address, he confirmed that gold had been found in the California Territory. In 1941, President Franklin D. Roosevelt unveiled his famous Four Freedoms, speaking in favor of the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and, of course, freedom from want and fear as well. The presidents have sometimes given speeches that were relatively short and sometimes relatively long. President Obama, his average is very much on the long side, but he is exceeded by only one president in recent years, and that, you will not be surprised, is former President Bill Clinton. Their average, Clinton at 7,426 words, President Obama at 7,004 words, President George W. Bush comparatively only 5,184 words, and the president, who arguably made the greatest use of the State of the Union address, that is President Ronald Reagan, his average was only 4,596 words. What will President Obama say? Well, Peter Baker, the New York Times, reports, perhaps more so than in any of his previous congressional addresses, Mr. Obama realizes that he has little chance of major legislative victories this year, with the possible exception of an overhaul of immigration law that Republicans are also making a priority. As a result, he will present a blueprint for a, quote, year of action on issues like income inequality and the environment that bypasses Congress and exercises his own personal authority to the maximum extent. Jeff Shishol, who is a speechwriter for former President Bill Clinton, said, quote, this presidency is not going to be defined from here forward by big legislative initiatives. As the New York Times said, and as the White House has confirmed, the president is expected to speak to the issue of income inequality. But as the Wall Street Journal's reporter Colleen McCain-Nelson notes, no one's exactly sure what the president is going to say. As she writes, President Barack Obama plans to make income inequality and economic mobility central elements in the State of the Union address and a focus of his remaining time in office. But how exactly the Democratic Party intends to talk about the gap between the rich and the poor is very much up for debate. It might be up for debate, we would add, even within the White House and even within the president's own address. President Obama has spoken to this issue in various ways in times past. It's going to be very interesting to see if he follows a uniform and consistent script when he talks about income inequality and matters of the economy in his 2014 State of the Union address. This is a very important opportunity for Americans. I have to say, however, not as important as it used to be in the past. In times past, especially in the past 30 or 40 years, the State of the Union address was must-watching for anyone who wanted to be aware of where the country was and where the country is going. But all that has changed, especially in the last 20 years or so, when the State of the Union address has turned mostly into political theater, when sustained political arguments have been reduced to sound bites and efforts at manipulated applause, when the applause to the address orchestrated by the respective parties, either the party of the president or the party opposed to the president, sometimes becomes the major story itself and the dynamic of the address. I still think it's a good thing for families, Christian families, to sit down and watch this speech. It's a good thing for children and teenagers to see that parents take the civic life of the nation seriously. it's also a very good thing to do a political consideration of the speech, and even more importantly, a Christian worldview consideration of the speech. What did the president say? How did people respond to it? What kind of argument did he actually make? What does that reveal about his worldview? And how do we engage that worldview with our own? One mark of the declining significance of the State of the Union address is that it is likely to make headlines on Wednesday and then be forgotten by Thursday. Then again, maybe lightning will strike. Maybe something will happen tonight that we'll be talking about even longer. Shifting to France, the farcical soap opera that has surrounded the French president François Hollande and the now dissolved relationship with his former live-in partner, who was recognized as France's first lady, all this has come to an official announcement from the French presidential palace that President François Hollande and his companion Valérie Trierweiler have officially ended their relationship. As Alyssa Rubin of the New York Times says, this officially brings to a close a two-week-long melodrama that began with a glossy magazine's report of an affair with an actress and Mrs. Trierweiler's emotional collapse over the disclosure. The French president said in a statement, quote, I have ended the shared life I had with Valérie Trierweiler. Now, this is a very interesting story from a Christian worldview perspective for a couple of reasons. First of all, we understand as Christians that you cannot sever personal character and public leadership. It is impossible. Americans, as a matter of cultural and moral habit, recognize a greater link between personal character and public leadership than the French say they believe in. On the other hand, the current controversy in France demonstrates that the French maybe aren't being as honest with themselves as they might be. They seem to be taking this issue with greater seriousness than in the past they have. François Mitterrand, the president of France a generation ago, also had a mistress with whom he had a daughter, and the mistress and her daughter appeared at his state funeral on the same par with his official family. In this case, François Hollande followed French President Nicolas Sarkozy, who had his own soap opera going. And now you have a French president who is not married to the mother of his children, never was married to her, never was married to the woman with whom he's now separated, who he claimed was the First Lady of France, and is not now married to the woman with whom he's having an affair, who may or may not become the First Lady of France, but the president says will never live in the presidential palace. The French seem to have lost the moral indignation to say that what the president has done is wrong, but in the words of one leading French commentator, he does look ridiculous. Perhaps ridiculous is now just shorthand for whatever moral umbrage the French can muster. But from a Christian worldview perspective, there's something else going on here, and that is made very clear in an article by Robert Zaretsky written from Paris. It has to do with the fact that the French government is now often referred to as the Fifth Republic. That is, it is the Fifth Republic put together in France's history, and it was inaugurated in 1958, largely written around the person of former General Charles de Gaulle, the savior of modern France, as he is credited with being. Charles de Gaulle defined a Gallic character. He was himself the epitome of France. He was a titanic figure on the world stage who was never seen in public without wearing either his general's uniform or a full suit. He was never seen in any casual setting. He was always seen as the epitome of France. In the same way that the founders of the American Constitution wrote the office of president with George Washington very much in mind, the only obvious person who would be entrusted with that kind of responsibility in the nation's founding, so also the French created the Fifth Republic around Charles de Gaulle. A statesman who was considered so dependable that the entire French government placed itself upon his personal reputation. But what Robert Zaretsky is writing about is the perils of trying to maintain a governmental system when you no longer have someone so trusted in office, when the presidency is so powerful as the French presidency is. As he writes, François Hollande is no Charles de Gaulle. He writes this, in a political system where everything spins around the great orb of the presidency, a weightless president can only cause havoc. Charles de Gaulle, who changed out of his suit only to don his general's uniform, was never featured on a magazine's cover wearing a bathing suit, nor did he ever ride a moped. Both of those things, by the way, have been done by the last two French presidents. Mr. Hollande won his presidential race on the promise of being Mr. Normal, but as the Gaullist model makes clear, there is no place for normal in this republic. This is even truer when the norm has, since former President Nicolas Sarkozy, centered on private displays of male potency and public displays of political impotency. One commentator, Franz Oliver Giesbert, suggests that Mr. Hollande is incapable of acting on the principle of omnipotence at the heart of the French presidency. But this raises a greater question. Is this the fault of Mr. Hollande's constitution or the Fifth Republic's constitution? It's a very interesting question. From the Christian worldview perspective, it just reminds us that you can't separate personal character and public leadership. Even the French, who say they can, Robert Zaretsky points out, wrote into their constitution the very necessity of the link they now try to deny. In saying that François Hollande is not Charles de Gaulle, what the French are actually saying is, character does matter, and we know it now by its absence rather than by its presence. Meanwhile, shifting back to the United States, in the context of our vast and very fast-paced sexual and moral revolution, looking at the issue of moral change, a big event took place on Sunday night, or at least it's claimed that it was a big event in terms of moral change. As Holly McKay reports for Fox News, this year the Grammy Awards weren't just about the music. They were also about making a statement in the same-sex marriage debate. Heavily hyped in the hours leading up to Sunday night show, 34 couples, both gay and straight, although one report says only one couple was straight, exchanged rings and said, "I do," as officiated on stage by performer Queen Latifah. The actress, rapper, talk show host was recently deputized by Los Angeles County to legally conduct wedding ceremonies and sign the marriage certificates for each couple. The event took place on a stage set to resemble a giant chapel with stained glass windows during a performance by hip-hop duo Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, in which they sang their hit tune, Same Love, a song embraced by the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community last year. In response to that, Robin Abkarian, writing in the Los Angeles Times, says the movement against gay marriage is starting to seem kind of silly and outdated. No, the Grammys mass wedding moment Sunday, when 33 couples, including a sprinkling of gay ones, were joined in matrimony by Queen Latifah, might have been a stunt, but it was an effective one. There's no better way to normalize gay marriage than to simply show it. End quote. It's a very interesting argument and one that's gaining traction. Shortly after a gay victory at the polls, USA Today said that the best support for the gay rights movement was coming from Hollywood and the entertainment industry. One of the things to note, however, from a worldview perspective, is that that industry is often more self-congratulatory about its moral influence than it is actually capable of accomplishing. It's hard to say whether or not there was any major moral change that took place on Sunday night, as millions of Americans saw these couples married by Queen Latifah. But to put it as bluntly as I can, the kind of people who were changed in terms of that moral change are the kind of people who can be morally changed by watching Queen Latifah perform a mass marriage ceremony during the Grammy Awards. Perhaps you know who you are. But from a Christian worldview perspective, we do need to recognize that popular culture does both reflect the culture and influence it. Sometimes it's very hard to measure which is which. A recent drop in teen pregnancy was claimed by MTV as having been caused by one of its reality television programs that supposedly shows the reality of teen parenting. It's very hard to say, either in terms of correlation or causation. It's very hard to say. But it's easy to understand that popular culture does reflect the culture. After all, popular culture only becomes popular if it indeed finds its way into the vast mainstream of the culture at large. On the other hand, does it influence and change the culture? Well, we know it does that too. One of the central ways we know that is by the determined effort of the gay rights movement to change the script on programs to include very positive and sympathetic gay characters. And what you have is the self-congratulatory claim by Hollywood that it's made a big difference. It undoubtedly has made a difference. How much of a difference, we can't know. But the reality is this: we must keep ever in mind the fact that millions and millions of Americans, indeed the vast majority of Americans, are watching and consuming, listening to a great deal of popular culture and all of its products and artifacts. And the reality is that to listen to that kind of music means you're listening to the message. To watch that kind of drama or comedy or entertainment means you are allowing that to become a new normal. Popular culture resets the picture of normality that the culture aspires to and sees as both normal and to be appreciated, even at some point to be protected. So popular culture does have an impact, and what took place at the Grammy Awards on Sunday night will have some kind of influence. How much? Who knows? But this much is clear: the people who could be influenced by such a thing, well, might have been. Meanwhile, in terms of things that reveal the American worldview, Aaron Blake, reporting for The Washington Post, offers a headline, GOP Congressman's Book, The Wife to Voluntarily Submit to Her Husband. In other words, it's headline news in The Washington Post that a United States congressman has written a book in which he argues that the wife is to voluntarily submit to her husband. Blake reports, a Republican member of Congress says in a recently released book that a wife is to voluntarily submit to her husband, but it doesn't make her inferior to him. The congressman is New Mexico Republican Steve Pierce. The book is entitled Just Fly the Plane, Stupid. It was released last month. Its publication, Blake says, and his acknowledgement in the book of the controversial nature of the submission debate came as the Republican Party reevaluates how it talks to and about women. In the book, Blake writes, Pierce recounts his rise to owning an oil field service company and winning election to Congress. In the book, the Vietnam War veteran says that both the military chain of command and the family unit need a structure in which everyone plays his or her role. He has said that in his family's experience, this has meant that his wife Cynthia would submit to him and that he would lead. Quote, the wife is voluntarily to submit just as the husband is lovingly to lead and sacrifice. He also quotes the Bible and then says, quote, the husband's part is to show up during the times of deep stress, take the leadership role, and be accountable for the outcome, blaming no one else, end quote. Blake then goes on to explain that the Republican congressman is a Baptist who emphasizes repeatedly in the book chapter that submission doesn't mean inferiority, but rather that husbands and wives play different roles. He also says, Blake writes, that it doesn't mean his wife doesn't have a say in major decisions. Writing to a largely secular readership, Blake decides he better tell people where in the world this is found in the Bible. He goes right to Ephesians and says that according to the Ephesians text, the wife is to submit to her husband in everything, quoting the Bible directly from the New International Version. However, Blake goes on to affirm that in 1998, the Southern Baptist Convention adopted a statement within its own confession of faith that also affirms that the wife should, quote, submit herself graciously to the servant leadership of her husband, end quote. Why are we talking about this? Because it's headline news in the Washington Post. The Washington Post is not inaccurate in its coverage of this controversy, nor in the fact that there is a controversy. But what's most revealing about this news article is the fact that it made headline news in the Washington Post that a Republican congressman from New Mexico wrote a book in which he says, as a congressman, as a husband, and as a Baptist, that he intends to follow the Bible, and that his wife does too. This is considered so controversial to the Washington Post that it released an article with that kind of headline and goes on to have to explain why in the world a Baptist would hold to such a position when it's found in the Bible. But perhaps the other angle on this that should be very interesting to us is that the only angle on this that seems to make sense to the Washington Post, and perhaps this is understandable, is the political angle. In other words, what does this mean politically? What does it mean for the candidate? What does it mean for the Republican Party? What does it mean for the national political discussion? Missing from this is, of course, the point of the Bible. What does this mean for families, specifically for Christian families? You would think from this article that the big issue is whether Ephesians is going to fly in national politics. The answer to that, the Apostle Paul would almost emphatically insist, is no. It never has, and it never will. It wasn't written for national politics. It was written for the church. The real problem is not that the Washington Post would think that the teaching of Ephesians is controversial to the culture. The real problem is that it's often controversial in the church. Finally, I want to invite you to join me tonight, along with nationally syndicated radio host Dennis Prager and New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, for a conversation about faith and freedom in the public square. It's going to be live tonight, 7 to 9 o'clock p.m. in Alumni Chapel at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. It's a rare opportunity. One of America's leading Jewish intellectuals, a Roman Catholic thinker, and I will be joining together for a conversation about what's going on in this country and how we look at it. We'll agree on some things, disagree on others, but it's going to be a very lively conversation. That's from 7 to 9 o'clock tonight. If you can be with us, tickets are still available at #pros.com. That's #pros.com. And if you can't come to be with us, watch it live. You can find it live streamed on the internet at sbts.edu/live. That's sbts.edu/live. That's this event, in which I'll be on stage with Dennis Prager and Ross Douthat from 7 to 9 o'clock p.m. And then at 9 o'clock, the State of the Union. That's tonight's double feature. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.